Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. Pope Benedict XVI ends a four-day apostolic journey to Turkey, renewing his call to end divisions between Christians. And we take a look back at some intense and highly suggestive moments of the Pope's stay in Istanbul, as he visited the spectacular Santa Sofia Museum and shared a few moments of meditation with the Grand Mufti inside the city's famous Blue Mosque. And the abbot of the Abbey of St. Paul's outside the walls here in Rome reflects on the importance of the Pope's journey to Turkey and explains the differences and the similarities between the Latin and Orthodox rites. Friday, December the 1st, saw Pope Benedict XVI's farewell to the people and to the land of Turkey, before flying back to the Vatican after an intense four-day apostolic journey, his fifth since the beginning of his papacy in April 2005. In a parting message of goodwill at the airport, at the end of the visit, the Pope reiterated his profound belief that dialogue is a must in order to improve comprehension between different cultures and different religions. But before setting off for Istanbul's international airport on Friday morning, Pope Benedict celebrated Mass in the Cathedral of the Holy Spirit. Vatican Radio's Philippa Hitchin, who has been travelling with the Pope in Turkey, was there. She tells us all about it.
Pope Benedict ended his pastoral visit to Turkey on Friday with a joyful celebration of Mass in the Catholic cathedral located next door to the residence where he's been staying during these days in Istanbul. The residence on a small side street is well known as the place where Archbishop Angelo Roncalli, later to become Pope John XXIII, lived during his time as apostolic delegate in Turkey from 1935 to 1944. Dubbed by some as the first Turkish Pope because of his love of this nation and its people, Angelo Roncalli's experience here undoubtedly informed some of the profound ecumenical and interreligious changes he strove to introduce during the Second Vatican Council. His friendship, as well as his efforts to promote reconciliation and peace, are still remembered here in Istanbul, where the residence and the roads still bear his name, a surprising gesture in such a secular nation, where most religious manifestations are severely forbidden. Inside the Casa Roncalli and the cathedral hang portraits of the good Pope John. And as he arrived for the morning mass, Pope Benedict blessed a new bronze statue of his predecessor beneath a large stone statue of Benedict XV, recalling that pontiff's efforts to help Turkish victims of the First World War. In the courtyard outside the cathedral, a group of Austrian children were waiting to greet the Pope, cheering and singing and offering him four white doves that he released into the grey sky, another symbol of that great desire for peace, which has been the underlying theme throughout this visit.
For those who govern this country, Turkey, and for the governments of all nations, may the spirit of wisdom and intelligence guide their actions so as to favor prosperity and harmony, injustice and freedom for the peoples entrusted to them, thereby giving hope for true peace.
Inside, as well as members of the local Catholic community, were the ecumenical patriarch Bartholomew I, the Armenian patriarch Mezrob II,
Papa Hazretleri on altıncı Benedikti, büyük coşkuyla kilisemizde,
and a Syrian Orthodox metropolitan.
Bu ayine Katolik cemaatleri, Ermeni, Süryani,
all of whom the Pope had met and prayed together with the previous day. During the Mass, celebrated in a variety of different languages by members of the many different Catholic rites present here in Turkey, Pope Benedict urged all Christians to work together to share Christ's message of love and life with all of humanity.
Réunis ce matin dans cette maison de prière consacrée au Seigneur.
The Church's mission, he stressed, is not to preserve power or to gain wealth, but rather to serve and to share the living presence of the Lord with all men and women. In Istanbul, with Pope Benedict, I'm Philippa Hitchin.
Meanwhile, on Thursday afternoon, Pope Benedict continued his ecumenical and interreligious activities, meeting with the Armenian Patriarch and the Syrian Orthodox Metropolite, as well as with the Grand Rabbi of Istanbul.
Both interreligious and ecumenical relations were high on Pope Benedict's agenda on Thursday afternoon as he visited first one of Istanbul's most famous monuments, the great Hagia Sophia, and then made an unplanned stop at the nearby Blue Mosque, followed by scheduled encounters with the Armenian Orthodox Patriarch, then Turkey's Syrian Orthodox leader, and finally the head of the Jewish community here. Perhaps the most sensitive of all the events on this four-day papal journey to Turkey, the visit to the museum, previously known as Hagia Sophia, was closely scrutinized by the world's media, since this monumental structure, dating back to the 6th century and filled with glittering mosaics, was once a stunning Byzantine basilica, transformed into a mosque after the conquest of Constantinople in the mid-15th century. Both Popes Paul VI and John Paul II visited this great edifice, now under the protection of UNESCO. Yet just a few days ago, Turkish police were called in to remove a group of demonstrators protesting against the papal visit. Given continuing tensions between the Turkish state and the minority Christian communities here, Pope Benedict's every move was watched closely as he stopped to admire the ancient treasures, to sign in the visitor's book, and receive a vase with a replica mosaic of the Virgin Mary from the hands of the museum's director.
Now that museum is in fact a really incredible place. The original edifice that was built by the Emperor Constantine burnt to the ground, only to be rebuilt and inaugurated in the year 537 after Christ by the Emperor Justinian. Justinian wanted it to be the most superb since the beginning of creation. And in fact, as art and architecture professor Elizabeth Lev told Tracy McClure, he certainly spared no expense.
Justinian kept very meticulous records, and if you were to calculate the amount in money today, the church cost $180 million at the time.
$180 million. Wow.
That's
quite shocking, even for a building today.
It was quite an expensive building, and Justinian pulled in for the decoration of that building. He sent squadrons all over the world, the known world, to bring in columns and marbles. They even brought in objects from the eastern coast of the Atlantic, or the coast of the Atlantic in France. I mean, they brought in everything. So this would be a temple representing the whole world, in all of the beauties of the world in one space.
In fact, I know that they also took some of the Corinthian columns from Baalbek in Lebanon, the Roman imperial period.
He amassed beauty from everywhere under that one space, and against that space being the crossing of everything. And when he inaugurated it, rumor has it that Justinian exclaimed, "Solomon, I have vanquished thee." But something that really I think is a very good pinpoint to understand that beyond the glory and the expanse and the eighth architectural wonder of the world, the point of that building, which will be picked up again by Benedict XVI's visit to it this week, is in the court poet Paul the Silentiary, who wrote all the expressions of praise of the building for Justinian. And one line in it is that, "Thus through the spaces of the great church come rays of light, expelling clouds of care and showing the way to the living God." And that's what we hope this visit, this time, will be for both the churches of the East and the West.
The visit to the nearby Sultanahmet Kami, or Blue Mosque as it's commonly called, was a last-minute addition to the papal programme aimed at underlining Pope Benedict's respect for all Muslim believers. Rumour has it that Pope John Paul II also asked to make a private visit here back in 1979, long before he made his historic trip to the mosque in Damascus in 2001, officially the first time a pope has ever stepped inside a Muslim place of prayer. Following Islamic tradition, Pope Benedict removed his shoes before stepping onto the prayer mats inside the mosque together with the Grand Mufti of Istanbul and a group of imams who showed him around the huge domed building with its beautiful ornate blue and turquoise ceramic tiles and its low-hanging chandeliers. This 17th century masterpiece of Ottoman architecture, with its six soaring slender minarets and ancient library, can hold up to 10,000 people under its giant domes, and the Pope listened with interest as his host explained details of its history and decorations. As the Mufti pointed out the mihrab, which indicates the direction of Mecca, the two men stopped together for a few moments of silent meditation before exchanging gifts of mosaics and pictures featuring decorative doves, an important sign of the desire to overcome past tensions and forge together a path of peace.
The Pope had arrived in Ankara on Tuesday, at the start of his challenging four-day pilgrimage, a journey that he himself described as pastoral, not political. Its aim, he said, was dialogue, fraternity, and the commitment to understanding between cultures, for an encounter of cultures and religions, for reconciliation. The more I hear about Turkey, the more I would like to go there myself. Istanbul in particular, the place where East meets West. A sprawling city crossed by the Bosphorus River, which has one bank in Europe and the other in Asia, has exerted its charm and mysterious fascination on travellers, artists, writers and philosophers for centuries and centuries. As a matter of fact, the whole geographical area today defined as Turkey, a predominantly Muslim nation, is actually where much of Christianity, right from its very beginnings, flourished and spread.
In fact, it's strange because the whole of the ancient Near East was Christianized because it was within the Roman Empire. So from the period of Constantine onwards, in fact, the first Christian missions were in the Middle East, obviously emanating from Jerusalem to Samaria, to Judea, and then out to the ends of the earth, which was Rome, as is said in the Acts of the Apostles.
That's Father Edmund Power, the abbot of the Abbey of St. Paul outside the walls, here in Rome. I asked him whether he agreed that Turkey today represents a particularly special place for a Catholic pope to visit. Didn't St. Paul himself, I said, spend three particularly fruitful years there too?
Paul certainly was involved in setting up communities in what is now Turkey, then Asia Minor. The Christian roots are deep and long there, so you're right. It was essentially Christianity was the religion of those regions. And then with the rise of Islam, obviously things changed. It's interesting the way Islam was viewed at the beginning by Christians. Obviously, a lot was taken from Christian practice. It seems that the Prophet Muhammad had contacts with Christian hermits and so on, and a number of elements of both Judaism and Christianity are found within the Quran. But it seems that the Christians at the beginnings of Islam saw it as essentially a Christian heresy, among others, you know, an aberration of Christianity, but another form of Christianity, just as I suppose Christianity itself was seen as an aberration of Judaism, another form of Judaism at the beginning. It's only later, with the conquests and the military expansion and so on, and the great dominance of a large part, that Islam became the dominant religion of that area. And Christianity, therefore, although more ancient and although it's continued within those areas, has a much lower profile because Islam is so strong. So it's difficult, really, I suppose. People talk about the difficulty Christians have of practicing within a predominantly Muslim environment, and that does seem to be the case.
And that brings us right to one of the points currently under discussion in much of the media. The difficulties Christians in Turkey often face have been highlighted again and again these past few days. It's one of the effects of the Pope's journey. Another effect is to shine the light on Christianity's Eastern face, the Orthodox one, so different to the Western face in many ways, and yet so alike.
One obvious difference is the difference of language. Traditionally, the Greek, I suppose, is the original language of the Christian church in a way. The Jerusalem community maybe spoke Aramaic, but the New Testament is written in Greek, and that was the language in which the celebration, at least in the expanding church, once it moved out of Jerusalem. Then, of course, the language of the West was Latin. So the difference of language, although it was one Roman Empire, maybe also reflected a difference of culture. People say that Latin theology is far more legalistic and clearly defined, and the Roman mentality, whereas the Greek mentality is far more subtle and philosophical. So you can see a kind of a natural diversity, maybe. So when these people talk together, even in the early church, you know, how far they really understood each other is an interesting question. But at least there was unity at that point. If you look at what are the main differences nowadays, The sacramental practice, the concept of the sacraments, for example, the concept of prayer and so on, I'd say are not very different, really. A number of differences arise from the understanding of authority, because within the West, the idea of a very strong central authority, because there was only one apostolic see in the West, it was the ancient capital of the empire, Rome. With the decline of the empire, the Pope took on a great importance, a political importance as well as a spiritual one, and so his role became something very significant. In the East, however, different patriarchates, each jealous of their independence, meant that there was more maybe of a collegial sort of system in a way. There wasn't the one dominant figure. Now, that has advantage and disadvantage, I'd say, you know, because what one thing that seems to have happened in the Orthodox world is the growth of quite strong local or autocephalous, what they call autocephalous or self-ruled churches with their own patriarch or metropolitan. But they were often rather national, and because they were focused on particular countries. And so you had a group in unity with each other without a strong central head. The Patriarch of Constantinople was primus inter pares, had a position of honour, but not a sort of juridical position, whereas for political reasons in the West it was different. Now, the advantage of the West, I'd say, is that it can transcend national boundaries in a much more clear way. It's an international body. Although focused in Rome, the position of the Pope as a point of unity means that it doesn't matter whether you're English, French, German, Latin American, or Asian, that there's a unity. Whereas I think the independence of the local churches in the Orthodox is a stronger thing. I think probably within the Orthodox tradition, the concept of the papal primacy would be a particularly difficult issue to sort out. But there are other features that they have a similar ascetical practice, for example, the concept of celibacy, the monastic life and so on. There's an awful lot in common, and hopefully it would be possible to find some way in which the church could come into unity without actually losing the local richness.
Father Power's patient explanations have made things a little clearer for me, although the complexity of the issues highlighted during this journey call for much study and learning. What, I asked Father Edmund Power, do you see as the main challenges of this trip?
Well, the main challenge from the point of view of world perspective is obviously the challenge of his first visit to a predominantly Muslim country. And I think people's eyes are less on the Christian ecumenical dimension, which I think was the primary one, really, of going to visit the Patriarch of Constantinople. People now see it as an approach, or to see what he will do, what he'll say, how he'll seek reconciliation within the framework of a Muslim society that has been to some extent inflamed, it seems, by some of his remarks, particularly the Regensburg comment, which of course was made within the framework of an academic lecture. I think what the reaction shows, the whole population of Turkey is not going to be up in arms against him. Obviously, there's certain people who, with maybe a somewhat fundamentalist slant, probably. But in a way, what this does, it does strangely underline what, in fact, the Pope himself has hinted at, that, you know, there are cultural differences, that this strong reaction against a kind of academic approach to cultural questions on the part of people who believe very deeply their faith, but don't perhaps enter very easily into the Enlightenment mentality of the West, which takes academic discourse, freedom of speech, etc., for granted. It does underlie what Benedict himself said when he was Cardinal Ratzinger, for example, suggesting that maybe it wouldn't be completely easy for Turkey to enter the European community because of the big cultural difference, and that maybe, in fact, it's interesting, he wasn't criticizing its culture. He was saying that maybe it would damage its culture being brought too much into the ambit of Western culture.
Finally, I asked the abbot, What is your personal hope as regards to what the legacy of Pope Benedict XVI's journey will be?
My hope is not... Well, I'm looking at both aspects. I had the good fortune 3 years ago to be able to visit Istanbul in Holy Week, in fact, or the Orthodox Holy Week. That year it was the equivalent of our Easter week. So we'd already done Holy Week here in Rome and then went and did Holy Week in Constantinople, Istanbul. And we attended the Easter services, the liturgy at the Patriarchate, celebrated by the Patriarch. And I was struck at the difficulty of their life there, you know, that their church, quite small, a sense of siege. There were security checks to go in because the situation isn't completely secure. And how the community of Greek Christians in Istanbul had diminished it considerably in size. But they were very, very welcoming. It was a wonderful visit. There was a real sense of welcome. And I remember thinking how wonderful it would be if we could somehow build up again the Greek Church of Constantinople and maybe in some closer unity with us. So I hope that this visit of the Pope to the Patriarch will actually be a big encouragement, not just at that level, but also will build up the friendship between Rome and Constantinople, which is so important, really. The other thing, of course, in some ways more important for the world as a whole, is the whole East-West dialogue, East in the sense of Islam. And with all these difficulties, I just hope that his visit will enable those Muslims who come into contact with what he says to realise that his message is not one of crusading zeal, but one of seeking ways in which to be reconciled in peace in this day and age. And we know how much the world has suffered recently and has suffered throughout its history from conflicts and aggression and so on, and misunderstanding. So I hope it'll have that deeper purpose of maybe unity, not just between Christians, but also a greater unity between Christians and Muslims.
That's all from the English feature programme today, but we'll be back at this same time tomorrow, so join us then. You can also listen to our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. You're listening to Vatican Radio's English programme. Laudetur Jesus Christus.